My Classic Album with Mike Norris is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of My Classic Album and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.
It's just like a wall of awesomeness coming at you. That's how I would describe the whole album.
It's just been a lot of fun for me, Mike, to talk with you about this album at this moment.
It's something that everybody should hear at least once in their life.
It's fucking amazing!
You're listening to My Classic Album with Mike Norris.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of My Classic Album. As always, looking back on some of the greatest albums in music history. I'm Mike Norris and we've got a hell of an episode for you today. An amazing album, amazing guest. I mean, to be fair, I'm always really lucky with the guests that we get on the show. So passionate about the albums they love, so passionate about music in general, and it's great to go off on these wonderful tangents and just kind of geek out over classic albums. Today is a very special one for me, simply that I'm going to be chatting with one of my musical heroes, which, you know, to think that I get the opportunity to do that is just amazing. So today, I'm going to be chatting with Phil Collin, legendary guitarist from Def Leppard, who has chosen David Bowie's Aladdin Sane to talk about as his classic album. Received an email, obviously promoting the new Def Leppard box set, which is out now, covering the third era of their studio albums. So we're talking X, we're talking Yeah, and we're talking Songs from the Sparkle Lounge. That's out now, available on CD and vinyl with loads of extras. Absolutely worth getting. It's fantastic. And I just thought, well, let's just see if someone from Def Leppard wants to come on the show and promote that release. Didn't think for a minute that I'd get a reply. Oh, yep, Phil Collins, more than happy to come on. He'd love to talk about Aladdin Sane. So it's crazy how these things happen sometimes. So yeah, that conversation's coming up very soon. So excited for you to hear it. It was, you know, it's one of those things where they say that you don't meet your heroes. And to be fair, in this day and age, it is very much virtually kind of over online platforms, but it was an absolute joy to chat with Phil, and I hope that comes across in the conversation you're going to hear in just a few minutes' time. But we've also got some fantastic guests coming up over the next few weeks, and some great albums, really wide-ranging as well. I think we're really kind of going all over the place in terms of the classic albums that we're going to be talking about over the next few weeks, which is always fun. It's always exciting to mix things up. So in a couple of weeks' time, the 1st of August will actually be the 5-year anniversary of My Classic Album. And regular listeners will know we've taken breaks now and again. Obviously, we're on episode 52 today. Episode 53 will mark 5 years of My Classic Album. And to help celebrate that, Emily Johansson, drummer from a fantastic Swedish group called Thundermother, will be joining me to chat about one of my favourite Iron Maiden albums, Power Slave. So a great conversation. You know, if you're a Maiden fan, it's definitely one not to miss. You know, Power Slave, arguably the biggest Maiden album. Probably, you know, it's probably a toss-up between that and Number and the Beast for me in terms of which is my favourite. So, yeah, awesome chat with Emily, really getting stuck into Power Slave. That's coming on the 1st of August, where, as I say, that'll be 5 years of My Classic Album. It's crazy I've stuck it out that long, really. A couple of weeks on from that, it's going to be a really fun episode. So Ron Bumblefoot Thal will be joining me to chat about Yes's 1977 album Going for the One, which, again, is just an awesome album. Really enjoyed chatting with Ron about that. Going to be mixing things up, having a bit of fun on the social media channels at some point between now and that episode going out. Naturally, I'll be recording the links as I do for these episodes of My Classic Album. Now, Ron is a very highly acclaimed, celebrated guitarist, one of the best in the world, currently playing with Sons of Apollo. He's played in Guns N' Roses. You know, he is really, really a fantastic musician. Something else that he's very known for is his range of hot sauces. And on the social media pages, because I like myself a condiment, I like myself a sauce, I decided that I was going to put on there that while I'm recording the links for Bumblefoot's episode where we talk about Going for the One, I'm going to sample some of his hot sauce to see what it's like. And I put a couple of choices up there for the listeners of My Classic Album to choose. Thank you very much for choosing Bumblefucked, which is the 5th hottest hot sauce in the world from a couple of articles that I read in terms of kind of how they measure these things. So, yeah. So as I'm going to record the links for those, and Jen Majura has made me promise that I'll do that on an Instagram live, you know, so you can see me do that too. Obviously, get yourself, make sure you're following that page, My Classic Album Podcast, because there's a lot of fun stuff happens over there, as well as on our Facebook page. And obviously search for My Classic Album with Mike Norris, and following us on Twitter at MCA_podcast for obviously all the up-to-date information on the podcast. But it will be on Instagram, I imagine, Instagram Live, where I'll be recording the links for Ron's episode, but I'll be sampling some bumblefucked hot sauce at the same time. So if you fancy a laugh, I'll let you know ahead of time when that's going to be going online. And then we've also got a really great episode. And again, I like it when we kind of go in a slightly different direction. And I think for me, Annie Lennox has always been one of my favourite singers of all time. I think her voice is absolutely amazing. I love her work with Eurythmics, but I love her solo work. And fantastic singer-songwriter Reva Taylor has chosen Annie's debut album, Diva, to talk about on My Classic Album. So that'll be coming up as well. So there's some great episodes coming up over the next few weeks and some great classic albums. We've also got an anniversary episode that I'm quite excited to announce, but I'm going to keep that quiet just for now. I'll be having a chat with a former guest of My Classic Album, someone whose episode was very popular, one of the early episodes of My Classic Album, someone I know very well, and we've had a lot of feedback over the years at how much you enjoyed our conversation. I think that's partly because of obviously the nature of this podcast, but because we're good friends and have been for a long time, I think that really came across in that episode. So it's certainly out of the early ones that we did, I think it is one that people go back to a lot, that people really enjoy. That might be a clue for a few long-time listeners of My Classic Album, but until I've spoken to my guest again and we've got that all recorded, that'll be an anniversary episode. So if you're thinking towards the end of September, you're thinking a classic album that's reaching a significant anniversary that we haven't covered before, again, that might start to give you a bit of an idea of the album that we're talking about. But I'll be announcing that on social media in due course. The anniversary episodes are always really special, so hopefully we can get stuck into that at the end of September. That'll be a lot of fun. But I can't contain myself anymore. I think when I'd finished this interview that you're about to hear, you know, it was an absolute privilege for me, and I'm really excited for you all to hear it. My special guest today from Def Leppard is the fantastic Phil Collin. Before we get to my chat with Phil all about this fantastic album, let's just start and look at the facts. Here's the beginning of what you need to know about Aladdin Sane. Aladdin Sane is the sixth studio album from British music icon David Bowie. Coming off the heels of his breakthrough release, The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and The Spiders from Mars, Bowie toured America, his experiences of which informed the music of what would become Aladdin Sane. Much of the album was recorded upon Bowie's return to London, with producer Ken Scott and the titular Spiders from Mars reconvening with Bowie at Trident Studios. The album, which Bowie described as Ziggy Goes to America, was released with much anticipation on the 13th of April, 1973. The Gene Genie was Aladdin Sane's first single across most territories and proved to be a huge hit for Bowie. While only reaching number 71 in the US, The Gene Genie just missed out on the top spot on the UK singles chart, reaching number 2. Driving Saturday came close to matching that success, ranking a spot below in the UK at number 3. Stateside, it was Time, chosen to be the second single, but ultimately didn't chart. However, a cover of the Rolling Stones' Let's Spend the Night Together charted at number 109 in the US and proved a big hit in the Netherlands, reaching number 19 in spite of not receiving a UK release. After the huge success of Ziggy Stardust, there was huge expectation upon the release of Aladdin Sane. The album didn't disappoint, becoming Bowie's first number one album on the UK Albums Chart. On the US Billboard 200, Aladdin Sane peaked at number 21 and certified gold in the States. Aladdin Sane's success in Bowie's homeland earned the album platinum status, his last studio album to do so until Scary Monsters and Super Creeps. Critically, Aladdin Sane has been regarded as an important album in David Bowie's career and an essential album of the glam rock movement. In 2013, NME placed the album number 230 in its 500 greatest albums of all time, and US publication Fast and Bulbous named Aladdin Sane the 207th best album of all time in 2015. So that's just the beginning of everything we need to know about Aladdin Sane, but I have here with me my very special guest who chose the album to talk about today. A huge thrill for me personally. From Def Leppard, this is Phil Collin. How's it going?
Wonderful, thank you. Good to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. So just before we dive into this, why have you chosen Aladdin Sane to talk about on My Classic Album today?
So I think it's my favourite Bowie album. And, you know, I'm a huge Bowie fan. It actually, we hear this story all the time, but he really did change my life. I was like 14, a sponge, you know, just at that time in England and everything. And Starman came on and Top of the Pops, and it spoke, you know, even the image of it and the melody. And it was kind of a, you know, kind of like a very nursery rhyme-esque, you know, Starman is, but it spoke on many different levels. And it was just how he looked, and, you know, you're trying to find your identity. And I'd just been to my first concert, or was about to, which was actually Deep Purple, which was amazing, obviously. So I liked all of that, but David Bowie in particular spoke to me as a growing lad, you know, and you go, wow, this is what I want. It was different. It was the image and what it created, the whole package, really. So Ziggy Stardust was one of my favorite albums of all time, and I still love it. I played it yesterday. But I think that Aladdin Sane progressed so much from a maturity level. You know, I think that with Ziggy Stardust, he was still kind of throwing it out there. Hunky Dory had been folky and all that stuff. Ziggy was something else. But I think with Aladdin Sane, he knew what he was doing. It was like he had a image and a sound and everything else. And it had more of a purpose. And then it, you know, it went avant-garde. You know, you had Mike Garson playing piano and stuff like that, which blew me away at the time. And just the songs, it was just a really cool thing about a concept, was just really cool.
And I think, you know, obviously you've explained really well that first exposure to Bowie and that impact that it had. What is it about Aladdin Sane that you think exceeds Ziggy Stardust for you, in your opinion? Like I said, do you think it is that maturity and that development of what he was doing before?
More than that, I think, you know, with It Ain't Easy, there was a couple of tracks that weren't really, they were just throwing spaghetti at the wall and hoping some of it would stick. He was just going through that phase that an artist does, where they're still trying to find themselves as well. They're still trying to find their own identity. And obviously he's a chameleon, and we all know that. And he went through all these different things. I think with Aladdin Sane, it was the first, it was a purpose. I think the other stuff was still experimentation. It was still kind of improvising from an image point of view. It still wasn't 100% sure of what it wanted. I know we're talking about it, but the entity that was David Bowie, but I don't think he totally solidified what he was doing. He was trying, but I think with Aladdin Sane, there was a confidence and a maturity. Even some of the songs, they were slightly different, and it just had a different sound. Ziggy was a little bit piecemeal, some of it, you know, some of it wasn't really supposed to be on that. It was left over from Hunky Dory and all of that stuff. So, but Aladdin Sane was like, it was the band, it was solid, it was a concept, and it was, okay, let's push this boat out. If we've got Ziggy, let's push this out further and see what we can do. So for all those reasons, that's why I think I liked it. And I think I prefer the songs. I can put that on. I mean, it blows me away, Ziggy. I mean, I love it. But I when I hear that, there's something different going on.
So, you know, we've touched on the fact these two albums are obviously really close to each other. So there was Ziggy Stardust and The Spiders from Mars, Aladdin Sane following shortly after. Obviously, Bowie's commercial breakthrough. How much of an impact was David Bowie making in popular culture? So you've talked about the effect he had on you. What kind of impact was he having in popular culture at that point in your life when all of this was going on?
I think, you know, politically and as a kid, just growing up, you find a niche or something that you can fit in, that you can relate to. It's like a compartment, like these empty compartments going around. You don't quite fit in there, but this was a comfortable one. This is like, as I'm growing, as I'm getting into music, and my music has always been really crazy wide array of different things. I mean, just this week, I played with Slash actually for the first time. We'd done this thing called the Beastly Ball, which was great. We had a great time. But last Friday, I played guitar for Chaka Khan. These are the first two times I've been out, I'm playing, not in front of people, there's no people there, but playing as a live band. And it was really diverse and amazing, and I just loved both of it. So I've always been that way. With Bowie, it was, you know, I loved Zeppelin and Purple and Hendrix, and my cousin was getting me into all this stuff. But I could relate specifically as a 14-year-old. It was something that was like, well, I'm writing these songs for you. You know, you hear people say that they do it with Def Leppard. They go, I heard the lyrics to this song and I thought Joe was singing to me directly. It was kind of like that with Bowie. And I actually, I was fortunate enough to go and see the Aladdin Sane tour, actually, it was Earl's Court in London. I went to see that. That was just mind-blowing, you know.
And I mean, talking about that time period, so I know infamously this is around the time, so about 3 months after Aladdin Sane came out, he infamously killed off Ziggy at a London show on July the 3rd, 1973. So he addressed the audience in attendance. He said, of all the shows on the tour, this particular show will remain with us the longest, because not only is it the last show of the tour, it's the last show we'll ever do. So this like symbolic retirement for this iconic Ziggy. You know, do you think, was that the beginning of Bowie's kind of that renowned ability he had to reinvent himself, which you could argue he was doing on this album as well as all the subsequent albums he'd do?
I think he's always done that. And it was just the first time that it actually connected, that it actually clicked. All the other stuff, you know, the folk, even before that, you know, when he sounded like Anthony Newley, hello, it's David Bowie, and all of that stuff, you know, the 60s stuff. He was still trying to find his particular persona, if you like. You know, I know he had many of them, but as most great artists have, that it grows all the time. It's a constant, you can't be stagnant. If you're a real artist, it just kind of constantly goes. You see it in art, like Picasso. You know, he started, you know, they always say painting like a master as a kid, and then ended up at the end of his life painting like a child. You're doing these weird kind of weird shaped, you know, what we associate with Picasso. And I think with Bowie, it was just a constant evolution that was still going on. And I think that's the first time he was able to actually say in public, I've evolved and I'm allowed to evolve. Because before, he was trying to find a niche, something that would click, people would relate to it. But, you know, with this one, it was like, this is who I am, so now I can move on.
And Bowie talked about this transition from Ziggy to Aladdin Sane with Rolling Stone magazine. So he said, there was a point in 73 where I knew it was all over. I didn't want to be trapped in this Ziggy character all my life. And I guess what I was doing on Aladdin Sane, I was trying to move into the next area, but using a rather pale imitation of Ziggy as a secondary device. In my mind, it was Ziggy goes to Washington, Ziggy under the influence of America. Do you think there's an element of that? You know, if I've heard the album called performances like a side title, like Ziggy Goes to America. You know, do you think that there is kind of that America being a bit of a theme throughout the album?
I think if you're ever sung in any band in England or whatever, you've always got that. I mean, we certainly, the amount of time people said, well, you guys sing with an American accent. We had no idea you're British when you start talking. And that I didn't realize that. And the reason that is because popular music is an American art form, you know. I mean, without getting too deep into the history, you know, it started in, you know, in the Delta, you know, gospel and slavery and all of that, and singing acoustic guitar blues. It evolved, electric blues. It went to gospel. It went to soul. It went to rock and roll. And English people, you know, were like, oh my God, this is amazing. We couldn't really relate on that kind of thing, but it's the reason we sing with American. I didn't realize that until a few years ago, actually. And I'm like, why do I sing dance? Why do I go, dance, little sister, dance? I mean, I wouldn't say that. I'd say I'm dance, little sister. Yeah, and it's because I learned from singing along. Actually, even English bands like Mick Jagger or Bowie or whoever, you know, they would be influenced by Stevie Wonder, Aretha Franklin, anything that come before it, you know, the blues stuff. And so that's what that art form is. It's actually a version, it's an American pop culture. So I think that with Bowie and any artist, it's always in the back of your head. You actually, you're catering that sound. It's part of that thing because it's an American art form.
And in order to kind of further support this kind of Ziggy Goes to America idea, I know most of the songs on the album, they were written during his 1972 tour of the US. And in his book, Loving the Alien, Christopher Sanford claims that Aladdin Sane shows how appalled yet fixated Bowie was with America. Is that something you would agree with? Is that something that you feel comes through in the music, in the lyrics?
I think it comes through with anyone who's ever toured America. You know, it's like, or been, I mean, I've lived here for 31 years, actually in this house, 31 years.
Yeah.
I actually, just a few weeks ago, I drove, you know, after I got vaccinated and everything, I drove across the country because I hadn't seen my three daughters. They live in South Carolina and Virginia. So I had to rent a car, slept in the car, and it was amazing. I've got to say, I've toured it a million times, but when you actually drive yourself and all of those things, you know, I was listening to playlists and singing along to stuff. American radio is amazing, and it's so light and dark. There's so much going on, and it's a country of extremes that I don't want to say coexist, but both that exist in America. So it's a very strange thing, you know. There's a lot going on. You know, the country was born out of it wasn't a great start, I've got to say. You know, it's like ethnic cleansing on a large scale. All of these things add up to what ends up being America. So you see all these wonderful things, but there's some awful stuff going on there as well. So you see that, you know.
Do you think, and I know obviously, you know, certainly Def Leppard's success in America has been absolutely huge, like arguably bigger than over here in the UK. Do you think that there's a parallel from that? Do you think that there's a connection to the album because of the American themes that run through it and your own success in America?
I just think that before we even knew that we were copying an American art form, we were singing with American accents before you did that. You know, obviously later on, you know, the Sex Pistols, Oasis, bands that come later, they would sing, you know. Oasis sound like they're from Manchester, and Johnny Rotten sounds like he's from London. So there's a thing there. But all the other stuff, you know, it was all heavily influenced. Certainly all the Bowie stuff, certainly the Stones, and everything, you know, the Beatles, you know, Queen, Zeppelin, The Who, all of that, you know, it was very much influenced by American stuff. And some of the time, you're not even aware of it. It's like you just hear this stuff from America and you want to do a version of it. So that's why we all ended up sounding so Americanized, if you like. And also relating to the culture or the cultures. There's so many different things that exist here. It's really fascinating.
And obviously, we're going to go track by track shortly and dive into some of these songs. But before we do, I wanted to touch on the album cover, because I know just before I hit record, you were showing me you've got your copy with you.
Yeah.
You know, often ranked amongst the greatest album artwork of all time. What is it for you that makes that cover of Aladdin Sane so iconic? What makes it this really highly regarded piece of art, really, beyond kind of cover art?
It's the lightning bolt. It's that. It's so... That's so iconic. You can lose all the other stuff, you know, the liquid and the hair and him actually. But the thing that always comes through, you see that all the time. You do that. It's like, oh, that's Bowie, right? Yeah. It kind of that's what it is. It's great, you know. It's also, I've actually got this album on vinyl, and I actually got, and this is the first time I've done this, I got Woody Woodmansey and Trevor Boulder to sign it when I played with them. You know, me and Joe played in the Cybernauts, which was, you know, we'd play all these songs live, and we were playing with you know, the original Spiders from Mars or two of them.
Yeah.
And so I got them to sign that. So it was pretty cool. So again, I love the artwork on it. It's pretty spectacular. But it's the lightning.
Yeah. I mean, I know Bowie talking about that lightning bolt. He'd said in the past that the lightning bolt over his face represented the duality of mind, specifically his feelings during that US tour when he was writing these songs. So he said, wanting to be up on stage performing my songs, but on the other hand, not really wanting to be on those buses with all these strange people. So Aladdin Sane was split down the middle. I mean, do you think, kind of, for all the plaudits, that critical acclaim that Bowie received for his music and imagery and all of that, do you think this is kind of an underrated side of him, that kind of subtle observation, these little things that perhaps that we miss sometimes, you know what I mean?
I think we miss them. A lot of fans miss them. A lot of people don't actually care about that part. They just love the end result.
Yeah.
And I think that's what it, I mean, yeah, we can talk about that. We can get into it, but the 14-year-old me would not have, or 15-year-old me would have gone, I don't even know what you're talking about. I don't even understand these lyrics. I just like how it sounds. Later on, once you've had that experience, it means something else. And you know, I've written songs myself, and you start writing, it comes out, and then you hear it like a couple of years later, and you go, that's not what I meant it to be. It's actually it's come out of something else. It's like a subconscious thing that comes through, and that's the great thing about art. It doesn't always have to be that obvious. Sometimes it kind of baffles even the person, you know, creating the art.
And I think, even, you know, obviously we talked so much about the lightning bolt, I think another part of it that maybe that I really like, certainly, you know, that the teardrop that's dropped, you know, just above his chest, which was apparently added by photographer Brian Duffy, adding this other element. And again, like I say, the reason that I've, you know, obviously different episodes, we touch on the album cover for longer than others. This one's been called by many the Mona Lisa of pop. And that's why I wanted to take a bit of time just to talk about it, because it's such an iconic cover. Absolutely.
It is. Yeah, actually, funny enough, my son Jackson had the t-shirt on the other. And it really is. It's so relatable to on lots of different levels. I've never heard it called that, but that makes total sense. Yeah. Like, even the back. That's before we even get into the booklet. So.
This is it. So now seems like a good time to dive in, and we'll go track by track. So we'll start with Watch That Man. So on original releases of Aladdin Sane, the vinyl included The City, which inspired the song in brackets after the title. So just for people, I'll drop them in as we go. So Watch That Man was inspired by New York. So the style on Watch That Man has been compared to the sound on the Rolling Stones' 1972 album, Exile on Main Street. I mean, what do you think about that? Can you hear like a Rolling Stones or an Exile on Main Street influence on Watch That Man?
Oh. I definitely hear the Stones on it, and I definitely hear New York. You know, I lived in New York for about a year. Actually, my wife's from New York as well. So it's obviously got a thing. It's got an excitement. It's got a vibe. It's got all of these different things, and certain things only happen in New York, and it's very, very much part of that. There's a culture that's completely different. So yeah, when I heard that song, even before I'd even been to New York, now I know it actually does represent it. For some bizarre reason, it does do that. As for the Stones thing, I actually thought that some of the other Stones albums sounded a bit more what you're describing that one. Exile on Main Street kind of does, but it that album was a bit like a basic blues album. I think that's why it got so many rave reviews. The genius of the Stones, I thought, was when they went, you know, Can't Always Get What You Want, Sympathy for the Devil, just these different things where they'd add. They took the blues and just gave it something else. To me, Exile on Main Street's mainly a bluesy album, but there's a connection with Stones and New York anyway, but absolutely for that song. And it's just exciting. Whenever I hear those chords, it's just an exciting moment. It's still, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, what's interesting about Aladdin Sane, again, making that comparison to Ziggy Stardust, is I feel like it takes like a more heavy, hard rock sound than previous Bowie albums. Do you think, obviously, when we've talked about Bowie having this almost kind of admiration, but then dismay for America at the same time, do you think that a hard rock sound is a good example of how that comes across musically?
I do, I think, but I think it's more that he'd moved on, that he'd actually solidified his... I don't want to say base, but solidified his platform. Mm-hmm. And it was like he could actually get more comfortable with releasing more of him. So that's what it sounds like to me. And even with the maturity and everything else, it's more theatrical. It's got bigger, wider parameters. I heard a great story. You know, we know Mike Garson, who played with him for years. And Joe was telling me a story about when, I'll get to this when we get to the next song, but he was an avant-garde jazz player. And the fact that you could add that into the mix and it still sounds great.
Yeah.
Even to me as a teenager, it didn't sound wonky or weird. It just sounded like almost a little spooky and crazy, but it just fit in there so well. And sometimes I remember we played a festival once, and there was an avant-garde jazz festival going off downstairs, and that people hitting pieces of pottery or something as part of the sound. And it was pretty, I get that. That's hard to take in or grasp. The way Bowie introduced it or allowed it to work side by side with him was genius. It was like you just dug it.
And so Watch That Man, it's one of the most used examples for anyone who kind of levies any criticism at the album, because I know that some critics thought the album was rushed out, and this was evident in Ken Scott's production. In this instance, it's been said, so NME, for example, had said that the vocals were too low in the mix as a result of hurried shoddiness. Do you have an issue with Bowie's vocals in the mix?
I love it when the critic from NME or anywhere has this expert opinion on how. I've never even thought that any of the stuff sounds low in the mix or rushed. I actually think it sounds pretty slick, the album. I love Ken Scott. I mean, from everything from the Jeff Beck stuff, Stanley Clark, the jazz rock stuff and the Bowie stuff. Love, love, love Ken Scott. So I have faith in his production pretty much with everything he does. I even do this to this day. I heard something a few weeks ago and I'm like, this is a great, I forget what it was, but this is a great production. It was a 70s album. And I looked at the thing, it's like, geez, Ken Scott, wow. So no, I don't hear any of those things. And you know, I record stuff all the time. Actually, on this computer, I record stuff, mix stuff myself and everything. I've never thought that that sounded shoddy or low in the mix. It's what it's supposed to be. Yeah.
And I think, interestingly, so I know Ken had the opportunity to defend himself on the mixing. He was talking in David Buckley's book, Strange Fascination, David Bowie, The Definitive Story. And he'd said that when it came to mixing the track, they were using the vocal as an instrument rather than as a lead. So they put everything up front just to kind of showcase everything. The record label had then said to him that they wanted a mix with the vocal more up front so they could hear more of David. When he did that, they were like, actually, we like the original version in the first place. So they went with that. So it seems like it was more of a calculated thing. And like you say, kind of trusting Ken Scott, of all people, trusting him with that production rather than, you know, saying, oh, it's a bit low in the mix, mind.
Right, yeah. It's fascinating when you do. I've actually spoke to people. Actually, people have been reviewing shows and they go, oh, man, sound was terrible. It was tinny. And it's like, but you're sitting next to a tweeter. I saw you sitting up there the whole time. You was next to this tweeter. It's like, they shouldn't even sell that seat. And someone bases it on that. If I was going to a show, if I was going to review a show, I would go to the mixing desk. I'd go walk around the room. I'd actually absorb the thing. Yeah. And I find it fascinating when you get the armchair, you know, experts on especially stuff like that. Because I actually thought that this was a great sounding record. I think all the instruments sound great. His voice is amazing. And it gets the song over in the right way. I really, really like that. Yeah.
So let's move on to the title tracks. Let's move on to Aladdin Sane. So inspired by RHMS Elenis, as well as being the title track for the album, it's been described by many as a pivotal track on the album, which is often the case with title tracks. You've started to touch on it a little bit already. How important do you think this track is to the album as a whole?
I love it. It's very haunting. There's a couple of really haunting songs on there, which is a kind of a word I rarely use, but this and Lady Grinning Soul have this kind of haunting, mesmerizing effect. You know, it's got this crazy avant-garde jazz, you know, amazing pianist playing this stuff. Mick Ronson's playing this gong, gong, gong. And it's just rock. It's just this basic rock thing. And off Mike Garson goes. And it's got just wacky stuff, you know, a saxophone with Bowie playing it. And just the whole thing is just like, the first time I heard it, it just blew me away. I didn't know what to make of it. I wasn't sure whether I liked it or not. Mm-hmm. I obviously did, but it's just too weird. So the next time I heard it, I was like, this is brilliant. And I don't understand it, but I like it. Which is what art should be. It's like, as a Jackson Pollock, I don't know if it's number 5 or something, it's at the Tate Modern, and it's the giant one. It's just a bunch of things like that. I really like it. And you know, I'd be the first person to call that bullshit when it comes to, you know, some art just doing it for the sake of it and getting away with it. Mm-hmm. But I personally like this thing. So this had a slight bit of that, but more than that. Over the years, I come to love it, every element of it, but especially the piano solo. It was just it went off, and it was something I'd never heard anything like. I still haven't, actually. It's still really unique and still one of my favorites.
Yeah. And I think interestingly about that, so Mike Garson's solo was actually recorded in one take. So we recalled in 2008, he said, I told Bowie about the avant-garde thing. When I was recording the Aladdin Sane track for Bowie, it was just two chords, an A and a G chord. The band was playing very simple rock and roll. And Bowie said, play a solo on this. I just met him, so I played a blues solo. He said, no, that's not what I want. Then I played a Latin solo. Again, Bowie said, no, that's not what I want. He then continued, you told me that you play avant-garde music. Play that stuff. I said, are you sure? Because you might not be working anymore. So I did the solo that everybody knows today in one take. I always tell people that Bowie is the best producer I ever met because he lets me do my thing. So that's just such high praise and awesome insight into that solo.
Absolutely. And it sounds like that. It sounds, there's a freedom to it and liberty and everything. It's like, whoa. And it just, again, it creates an image. The idea of a great song or a great book is that you create an image, and you know, a great book, you can read it first few lines as in a song, and all of a sudden you have this mental image of what it's like. This song does that on a sonic point of view. It actually creates something, and you can actually see these colors and where it's actually what it's about. It's like, do you know what I mean? It's very deep, actually.
And I mean, talking about that, the song's apparently inspired by Vile Bodies by Evelyn Waugh, a novel that Bowie was reading at the time about the decadence of London society between the two world wars. And interestingly, on certain releases of the album, the track in its title has a series of dates in parentheses. So it says 1913 to 1938. So the obviously years between the two world wars, and then 1970 question mark. Was there anything kind of happening at the time that you think might have helped Bowie to kind of come to such a belief that perhaps we were heading towards a third world war, or perhaps maybe this song was about some of that decadence he was seeing in America while he was on tour?
I think it's humans are pretty scuzzy as a whole. We're not civilized by a long shot. We have like we have cities that are partially civilized, mm-hmm. and we have moments that are semi-civilized, but overall we're pretty uncool. You know, we war for no reason, and well, there's always a reason behind it, but it's kind of wow, you think you could arrive at a better conclusion with a different kind of approach. And I think with anyone you could actually go, well, yeah, this is not going to end well. It's going to end in tears. And I was looking at the news this morning. The Hoover Dam, there's so little water. This is crazy. It's down 130 feet, and the water can't flow. So they're expecting maybe LA and some areas. The electric's not going to work. But we carry on just like juicing and just everything. It's amazing. You'd think there'd be a solution, but yeah, we still keep doing that. So I think Bowie was pretty on point. I think, as you know, I think it's pretty obvious that we're not a cool species. We've always been that way. You look at history. There's this great series of books called History in an Hour, and I've read a bunch of them. It's like World War One, South Africa, the Civil War, you know, English stuff, you know, Hastings and all of this stuff. And you can read it in an hour, and the conclusion is always the same. It's like it's the same play with different actors. So I think Bowie, while he's been alive, you know, you can relate to some of these, certainly World War, you know, situations, and pretty much figure out where it's going from there. So, yeah, no, I think he was on it.
And there's plenty more to come of my chat with Def Leppard's Phil Collin, all about David Bowie's Aladdin Sane. It's a sentence I never thought I'd get to say. Pretty exciting stuff. Obviously, I hope that you're enjoying it. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this album, my chat with Phil, anything in general, really. Absolutely, get on those social media pages. Make sure you're following us on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. You know, I gave those addresses earlier on there, but just as a recap, just search for My Classic Album with Mike Norris on Facebook, if that's something. Facebook is your social media channel of choice. Follow us on Instagram at My Classic Album Podcast, or follow us on Twitter at MCA_podcast. And again, in terms of getting in touch with us, if you go to myclassicalbum.co.uk, there is a section where you can send messages, and I read all of them personally and reply to them personally. So yeah, absolutely, I'd love to hear your thoughts on what Phil and I are talking about, not just with the album, but a lot of the other stuff that's branching off in our conversation too. It was really interesting. But we've got some great stuff coming up over the next few weeks. I talked about it at the beginning of the episode. Let's just hear a few little snippets of some great episodes coming up with the likes of Emily Johansson, Reva Taylor, and Ron Bumblefoot Thal. Some fantastic guests and some truly classic albums to get stuck into over the next few weeks on My Classic Album. Here's just a taste of what to expect. Starting with our next episode, Emily Johansson and I talk about Iron Maiden's Power Slave.
Power Slave is a great album that really sums it all up, what Iron Maiden is. It's a lot of energy, it's a lot of guitars, great guitars, and good drumming, fast songs, and yeah, it just has everything. It doesn't have ballads, though, but Maiden is not really a ballad band, so their excuse. Yeah. It was so cool, like, I was outside of the Compass Point Studios in Bahamas because we were playing on the Kiss cruise, and we did a stop on Bahamas, and we went to the Compass Point Studios because AC/DC had recorded Back in Black. And then somebody told me, because I was wearing a Maiden shirt, he was like, "Do you know Iron Maiden recorded Power Slave here?" And I was like, "You fucking kidding me?" You know, I just took my shoes off because I was like, I'm walking on holy ground. I need to walk barefoot. Like, that was just huge, you know. It was really cool.
Ron Bumblefoot Thal goes for the one Yes album that means the most to him, 1977's Going for the One.
And it's funny, you touched on there about those personnel changes, you know, particularly within kind of keyboards. And for me, that's part of the story of Going for the One. I feel a key player in that, and there's no pun intended when I use that phrase, it's got to be Rick Wakeman. And it's funny, just for anyone who maybe is curious as to why he maybe had a creative dissatisfaction at that point, he did say to one interviewer at the time, "Tales from Topographic Oceans is like a woman's padded bra. The cover looks good, but when you peel off the padding, there's not a lot there." So that was Rick's thought on the album.
He is such a funny guy. You know, if he wanted to quit music and be a comedian, he'd be just as successful. I've seen, which was it? It was when they were receiving an award and he was giving a speech, and it was one of the funniest things I've seen. Yeah. I wish I could remember which one it was, but definitely he has a way with words. He's very, just such a funny guy.
And I think along with that, and I wish I'd been witness to this, because it's something that quite famously happened during that tour, that during a particularly indulgent moment for the rest of the band on stage, Rick famously ordered a curry and had it delivered on stage while he was waiting for them to finish up. So
there you go.
Yeah. So obviously wasn't happy at that point, but as you'd said, and we'll get into this as we go on, like, you know, he does return for this album.
And singer-songwriter Reva Taylor joins me to chat about Annie Lennox's classic album, Diva. Now, you know, it's Annie's debut solo album. And for many listening today, their first exposure to that unmistakable voice will most likely have been when she was one half of Eurythmics with Dave Stewart. So I'm sure we'll talk plenty about that transition from being part of a duo into a solo star. What are your thoughts on her body of work with Eurythmics? And what was so special about them that meant that a solo album like Diva was so highly anticipated?
Oh, yes. That's an interesting one. I mean, I am also obviously a fan of Eurythmics. I'm looking up a vinyl on my wall of the Eurythmics. And again, it is that voice that sort of cut through there. I really like the transition that she's made into this album from that world. It's far more... I need to choose my words carefully, because it's obviously what they had done together was completely groundbreaking. This actually, I think, does make a stark transition. And I think it's a shift away from a slightly more synthetic world into more of a blend, I think, of synthetic and organic sounds. I think it's a slightly like more real sound, and again it's probably pays testament to her writing this on her, you know, by herself. So for me, obviously I've listened to both, and you know, you can't beat Sweet Dreams when you're in the right mood. But for me, I think this solo work actually does trump Eurythmics for me across the board.
Make sure you don't miss any of these fantastic conversations here on My Classic Album by subscribing to the show or following us on social media. My Classic Album with Mike Norris on Facebook, at My Classic Album Podcast on Instagram, or at MCA_podcast on Twitter. All you need to know about the show is over at www.myclassicalbum.co.uk. So let's move on to arguably my favourite track on the album. So this is Drive In Saturday. So again, Seattle, Phoenix is the cities kind of referenced on the original release. So one of the singles released on the album, Driving Saturday, almost this kind of 50s doo-wop sound in some ways, but due to its subject matter, has this really kind of futuristic element to it. And it's often regarded as a good example of his fondness for what some kind of coined as like futuristic nostalgia. So songs from the perspective of someone in the future, reminiscing almost. Is that a common theme that you've noticed in Bowie's work, particularly perhaps at this stage in his career?
It is. And one of the things, when I first heard that, it reminded me of Clockwork Orange, the Kubrick movie. You know, a lot of the imagery, it just kind of, that's what I was thinking. I related to that. And I'd seen that probably, it came out in 71, I think, Clockwork Orange. So, yeah, it was like a year and a half before. So immediately went to that imagery. It was great. Yeah, the Clockwork Orange, the droogs with the boots and all, everything. It just reminded me of that for some reason. I love the fact that, you, like you referenced, it's got this kind of old rock and roll 50s, late 50s, early 60s kind of dunk, dunk. It's wonderful. We chose this on our Yeah album when we did the covers,
yeah,
because we didn't want to do an obvious song. So I've never heard anyone do a cover of that. Not successfully. I mean, you other covers, but I hadn't heard that. So we were quite pleased about that because, yeah, I love the song. Me and Joe have always just loved it because it's different. It's not the norm, but it still works in that context.
And I mean, kind of lyrically, it's a drive-in Saturday. Looks at a post-apocalyptic society where people have gone to a drive-in to watch porn as they've all forgotten how to have sex. So like, surely, when I'd kind of heard that and kind of sort of made that link, I felt like surely a song like that could only have come from the mind of David Bowie. Like, I don't think it could have come from anywhere else.
Absolutely. But the other thing about it is it reminds me of stuff that happens now that actually even in the 80s and 90s, it's still relevant in that environment. You know, a lot of people can't do that. So they get AIDS and all of this stuff. So it didn't seem too far in the future. It actually seemed almost present, really, to be quite honest. Actually, when I heard it, I mean, I know it's about the future. And like I said, the Clockwork Orange thing is the future, but it's got a relatability to it that could almost be now, you know?
Yeah. I mean, if the previous, obviously, we're talking about how that previous track, Aladdin Sane, almost kind of looking at like decadence and debauchery just before a fall. Do you feel like maybe like Driving Saturday is almost the consequence of that?
Absolutely. And I don't know this if this was done on purpose, but I know they used to do that, back in the 70s, there would be more of a concept with an album. Mm-hmm. You know, they would flow on. Bowie does it all the time. You know, it's each song is related, if not, is relatable. And exactly what you said, I absolutely believe. Yeah, it is Garden of Earthly Delights. You know, it's got heaven, like a heaven thing. It's got man, and it's got a hell. What could be? And this was like from 1400 and something.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Hieronymus Bosch painting.
So while doing my research for this chat, I actually discovered that Bowie, he offered this song to Mott the Hoople, who rejected it. And that really confused Bowie, and it led him to shave off his own eyebrows in frustration. So obviously, as I said, we know, you know, Mott the Hoople and all the young dudes, it's very much something intrinsically linked. Do you think, had they covered Driving Saturday, do you think that would have worked out well for them?
I didn't know that, but I think that would have been a good song for them. But they were doing their thing by that point anyway. You know, whether it was Honolulu Boogie or whatever, it was kind of cool. But yeah, now you mention it, I think they'd done a killer version of this. It would have been cool. Yeah.
And just one more thing before we move on, because I know obviously you'd said that you chose to cover it on Yeah, on the Covers album, which I know is part of the box set that's coming out like imminently. Yes. Did you ever get that opportunity to get any feedback from him as to what he thought of the cover or anything like that?
No, I mean, Joe had, I'd met him briefly a couple of times, but Joe had spoken to him. In fact, he said they were talking about the version of All the Young Dudes, one of the versions, and Joe said, I've got a copy of that on a cassette. But he said, really? Could you get it to me? So he gave him this version of All the Young Dudes that he didn't have. I think it's him doing the vocal over the Mott the Hoople thing with Ronson on. I mean, it was a different version. Pretty cool, yeah. So, but no, I don't know about that song. No, yeah. That would have been nice.
So let's move on to Panic in Detroit, naturally inspired by Detroit, Michigan. So Bowie wrote the song inspired by Iggy Pop's experiences during the 1967 Detroit riots, the third biggest riot in US history. It resulted in 43 dead, over 1,000 injured, over 7,000 arrests and more than 2,000 buildings destroyed. Allmusic.com calls Panic in Detroit one of the hardest driving numbers that Bowie ever recorded. Would you agree with that? Does it feel like a really hard driving number by Bowie standards?
It does. You know, I think you know you've got, like I said, the parameters on this album were pretty wild, and it did. I always, you know, especially as a young guitar player, It really spoke to me. It was like, oh yeah, this is cool. That and Cracked Actor, you know, the feedback and everything. That this, yeah, Panic in Detroit was really cool. Again, you know, all of his lyrics, they sum up this, you know, even It looked a lot like Che Guevara. You know, all of a sudden, you know what this guy looks like. Mm-hmm. Drove a diesel van. It's like, wow, you got this perfect image. And again, you know, and then you mentioned the Iggy Pop thing. You know, you listen to Search and Destroy. I was actually listening to Raw Power the other day, which Bowie did produce. It's really rough and raw, but it's great. I prefer it now than when I did when I first heard it. It's like, well, this is cool. And this does have elements of that. So I think you mentioned in that it's definitely influenced by the Iggy Pop vibe, you know, and the Stooges, the raw power of it.
So in 2003, and obviously we've only touched on him a couple of times, which is a bit of a real disservice to him, to be honest. But in 2003, Rolling Stone magazine named Mick Ronson among the 100 greatest guitarists of all time. And they singled out Panic in Detroit as his essential recording. I mean, what are your thoughts on Mick's contribution to the song? And how important is he to David Bowie's career at this point with Aladdin Sane?
He was so important. He was so instrumental. And I think that none of this, it may not have happened if it hadn't have been for Ronson. There was a chemistry. He didn't get enough credit for what he did. And I think he was able to get even the early stuff, you know, the folkier stuff. All of a sudden, it gave it an edge. The hunky-dory stuff, Queen Bitch and stuff like that, all of a sudden, it was like you could see where this was going. And with Ziggy, it was just really instrumental. I actually think, and these are my three favorite Bowie albums, actually, Hunky Dory, Ziggy Stardust, and Aladdin Sane. So it was that period, the Spiders. And I do think Mick Ronson had a major contribution. I think Moon Age Daydream is my favorite Ronson guitar solo. I love everything he does. I actually just recorded something recently. This will be out later on, but we'll get to it because it's about one of the other songs on this album as well. So cool. I'll touch on that when we get to it.
Yeah. So let's move on to Cracked Actor, so Los Angeles in parentheses in this case. Another hard rocker, but a Hollywood actor meeting up with a prostitute. The chorus in particular has some not so subtle lyrics pertaining to sex and drugs. I mean, again, bearing in mind kind of how iconic Bowie already was at this point, kind of in the 70s, and the image he portrayed. Was there much kind of controversy around lyrics such as Suck Baby Suck, Give Me Your Head? Or do you think that was kind of sort of hidden amongst kind of other songs that were released off the album?
It was hidden. And, you know, I remember back in England, you know, that no one even knew what head meant. You know, it was a very American slang phrase for getting a blowjob. But back then it was like, it was American. So when it came over to England, you know, it had a totally different meaning. It was like, well, okay, what is that head? What do you mean? So with that one, I mean, again, you know, when I first come to America and lived in California, you know, you'd Sunset and Vine. I drive by it all the time. And every time I go through there, I think of this song, you know, Caught Yourself a Trick at Sunset and Vine. It's like, whoa, baby, you're a poor. It's like amazing, amazing imagery. And especially the LA thing, you know, it really sums a lot of it up. And yes, it's a great story, and it's stuff that happens all the time.
So, I mean, NME again, obviously talking about kind of being critical, it kind of harks back to about 10 minutes ago, but NME are quite critical. In 1981, they were quite critical of this song, believing the song reveals little else except that Bowie's capabilities with a mouth harp are decidedly limited. Do you think, is it a weaker track on the album, or is it one of your favourites? Obviously, we've talked about already that you think that criticism sometimes isn't warranted.
I don't think it's valid. I love the track, you know, and for me, the whole, it works in the context of the whole album. You know, what really happened in the 80s, you know, music used to be an art form. I mean, it still is, but it became more of a business agenda from the 80s onwards. It was like, how many units can you sell? How can we sell them? And we don't really care about who writes the songs, what they are, as long as we've got one and we can get radio play or MTV or whatever it is. Yeah. So anything before that is slightly magical. You know, it's like the early Bowie stuff, you know, Stevie Wonder, a talking book. These albums were just amazing. You know, the Stones, the Beatles, all of this stuff from back then. There was a real artistic thing about it that kind of disappeared. It disappeared because when people became you know, more fussed about the business agenda. And like as we are now, you know, you can see TikTok, YouTube, and da 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 da, and what matters, likes, and da 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 da. And unfortunately, the art part of it just keeps getting knocked out the way and becomes less important. I think that's kind of sad. No, I think this was a great song. And back then, you know, even Ziggy Stardust, like I said, that was a little bit of a jigsaw puzzle. It was like, oh, we got a song left over from that. I'm just going to chuck it on there, even though it's a little bit out of context.
Yeah.
It still works for me. You know, it's when you play the album a few times over, like we did it with Hysteria. There was two songs in there we didn't quite finish off. You know, if we'd have just had a little bit more time, another year or two, Don't Shoot Shotgun and Run Riot, which I love, by the way. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think they're awesome. But I do think both of those songs could have been a bit better. The chorus and whatever. And we didn't quite get there. We had this other stuff and it didn't really matter. You know, again, in the context of the album, they sound wonderful. And if we had changed it and made it sing, perhaps it would have been too much. I don't know, you know. Having said that, you know, back to this, it works in the context of the album. I love it.
Just while I've got the opportunity, while we were talking about Hysteria, anyone who listens knows it's one of my favorite albums of all time. I think Run Riot might actually be my favorite track on Hysteria. I absolutely love it.
Thank you. I love it as well. I really do. But it just from a time, how much we put into some of these other songs, it was like, oh, that'll do. Even the title, Don't Shoot Shotgun, it was a working title. And it was not really meant to be Don't Shoot Shotgun, oh, it sounds great. Yeah, da, da, da. I don't know what it means, but it was just a guide. And we kept it actually from my original demo, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. And Run Riot was a little bit like that. It was like, you know, like I said, you know, we may have ruined both of those songs if we'd have tried a bit harder. But they didn't get as much time and effort on them as some of the other songs did on the album. So having said that, they sound great. I wouldn't change a thing, really.
Talking about time, which we were, that's actually our next song. So a nice little segue there. New Orleans, another experimental track described by author Chris Needs as burlesque vamp. So I've felt so far that the placement on this song has been really deliberate, like when we were talking about, obviously, Aladdin saying in A Drive-In Saturday. In terms of opening up side two, how does time kind of do that for you? Do you think that placement is deliberate as the likes of, say, the title track and other ones we've talked about?
I do, you know, and it's an absolute relative to Aladdin Sane, the vibe of it. But again, you know, it kind of makes you think of Berlin, you know, in the late 30s, what was happening there, you know, just the way that it's got this thing. You just, when I was a kid, it just made me think of Marlene Dietrich and just that thing. And the New Orleans thing, I didn't really know it was about that, but that totally makes sense. So, you know, I've had some weird experiences in New Orleans myself, and it's been it's wonderful and really cool. But I, again, talking to you, I didn't realize that this was actually David Bowie's tour of America and you know, relating what he's actually seeing, the flavors of these different cities and everything. Detroit, you know, LA, you know, it's pretty and the underbelly, the dark stuff, you know, it's like which is everywhere, you know. It's like the amount of serial killers. Like, there's this TV show that's on really scary people, and I couldn't stop watching. It was on the other day, and I'm like, and this guy has killed, like, you know, 100 people here. It's like, really, 100 people? And it's like, get away with it. So there's so much of this stuff that goes on. Just a little bit of freakiness here and there is kind of fairly normal in comparison, you know?
Yeah. And we touched on kind of controversial lyrics before and things getting lost in translation kind of over the pond and stuff. Time has some pretty infamous lyrics of its own with the couplet, "Time, he flexes like a whore, falls wanking to the floor." That actually made it onto the US single edit because RCA, like you were saying, that over here we wouldn't have been aware of what head was. Americans weren't aware of what wanking was at the time.
And yeah.
Also released in Japan, obviously putting all the wank in the one side, which is probably not the best way to put it, but putting that to one side. Do you think that Time was a missed opportunity for another single from the album in the UK? Do you think it would have fared well as a single, perhaps with a radio edit?
I don't. I think that would have been a touchy subject, excuse the pun. But I think it would have been, it's not obvious, you know. And back then, the Bowie stuff, you know, that time period, Bowie, Bolan, Lesser, the Slade, the Sweet, other stuff, there was a flavor to all of those songs that was very similar. There was something to it. That's a little far out of that realm, I think. And I think, but it may be, you know, I mean, shit, I remember the first time I heard Bohemian Rhapsody. I'm like, really, they get away, and they got away with it. It was remarkable. I actually remember I got a puncture in my motorcycle, and this come on the radio because the van come to help me put the thing on. I'm like, this is Queen. What on earth is this? And it was long, and it was the best thing I'd ever heard because of that. I mean, it's a great song anyway. Bowie, he hadn't really done that. He touched on these kind of almost smaller vignettes, and they would say everything from John O'Money dancing and stuff like that. There was a small package, and you could get away with it. With time, it was a classic album track for me, and I don't know whether anyone would have got that.
And that's never a bad thing to be an album track, you know, particularly when there's the story of an album unfolding kind of as the tracks go on.
No, absolutely. I totally agree. You know, sometimes an album track's where you can really put all the meat and potatoes into it. You know, it's like you haven't got those restrictions. And so this one was great. And so even lyrically, I think it was in context with the whole song, I think it was perfect, really.
So let's move on to The Prettiest Star. So this is obviously written Gloucester Road, so back in the UK, because this one's got a more storied history beyond Aladdin Sane, as the original version was actually recorded in 1970 for a single release. So before we get in any deeper into that, have you heard that single version? Do you have a preference? I know obviously you were saying that Joe's got some kind of nuggets of rare David Bowie stuff at deep in his collection.
Well, yeah, what one with Mark Bolan playing that guitar lick.
Yeah.
Down, 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 which is like, whoa, really? And so you're just hanging out or whatever, and it's, I don't even know how these things go, but you're sitting in a room with someone, oh, just play this, and before you know it, there's some kind of magic going off. Again, you know, this kind of harps back a little bit to the Starman. My oldest son, who's now 31, when he was a kid, I would be playing this song. I always played Bowie. And he said to me, and he was like five, he said, why did the children boogie? I'm like, it's like, you know, let the children boogie. So the image of this and the sound of it and everything else has an innocence to it that reminds me of Starman. And it's great. It's wonderful. It's the only track on the album that's like that. And I think that's a great tonic. I think when you're doing an album, it is a jigsaw puzzle, and you start off with one or two songs and you go, okay, what works in context with that, either lyrically or sonically or even mood-wise? And that's more of the thing, is creating a mood to make this quilt, if you like. You know, it's a patchwork quilt or a jigsaw puzzle. And I think with Bowie, he done that spectacularly. It was like we've learned from him, actually, and people like that. That's how you make an album. It's a patchwork, and they have to be in context with it. You hear some albums and it's like all the way through. But with Bowie, it wasn't that. It was different flavors and exotic tastes, and it went here and there. And this was a perfect example of that. This kind of cheered things up a little bit, you know, from a melodic structure anyway.
Yeah. And as you've touched on, the original one, the original track, not the one on Aladdin Sane, but the original track featured Mark Bolan on guitar. Apparently Bolan's wife, June, remarked to Bowie during the session, Mark is too good for you to be playing on this record. for the re-recorded Aladdin Sane version, Mark Ronson recreated the Bolan guitar parts to the very note. Do you think that the song would have benefited from Ronson's own unique touch rather than replicating what Bolan had done, or are you happy with how the track turned out?
Oh, I love it. It's nursery rhyme-ish. So, you know, perhaps that's something he wouldn't have done. So I think it's great that he copied the Mark Bolan thing. It's great for The Prettiest Star. It's so beautifully played. You couldn't get that any better, the notes or anything. So, no, I'm glad he did. I'm glad he was faithful to the original plan.
So let's get to Spend the Night Together. Let's Spend the Night Together, a cover of the Rolling Stones track from 1967's Between the Buttons. We've already discussed the Stones' influence in opener Watch That Man. There's also a Jagger name drop on Driving Saturday, and Time tells us that Bowie would go on to collaborate with Mick Jagger years later. How influential do you think the Rolling Stones were on David Bowie early on, or do you think it's more that reflection of kind of what was going on in music at the time and he was trying to replicate that on the album?
I think now we're so far into the future, if you like, musically, it's very easy to not realize the importance of the Rolling Stones. They changed everything. I know Zeppelin took the blues thing and made it this massive rock thing. But I think what the Stones did, they took the same blueprint, but made it popular. They made it commercially viable. Jagger and Richards, they were sitting at a table, and if I'm not mistaken, Brian Epstein said, you should write these songs like Paul McCartney and Lennon. They said, okay. And one of, I forget what song it was, it Paint It Black. It's one of these early great, great songs. They started writing, and all of a sudden they were off and running. And it's a perfect blend and mixture. It was a hybrid. And I think all the hybrid stuff is the amazing stuff. I mean, Mutt did that with us, and he obviously did that with Shania Twain. He got country and made it palatable for a regular audience. Earth, Wind and Fire, it was funk and it was soul, but it was such great songs, such great arrangements, palatable. And I think that the Rolling Stones did that. They got blues music and actually made it palatable for the general consumption. So I think that they were a really important thing. There's also this other, you must have seen this thing, it's Bowie. He went to see the Stones supporting Little Richard somewhere in London, and the Rolling Stones come out, and it's Parkinson. Bowie's on Parkinson, and he says, the Stones come out, and someone sees him and goes in from the audience, get your ear cut. And Mick Jagger turns around and goes, what, I look like you? And it's just that, so obviously Bowie was a huge fan, and even stuff like that, he's just awesome when someone says shit like that. It's just absolutely killer. So he had to be a fan. You know, it's like there's certain people that you go, Jimi Hendrix, you know, and later, you know, Prince. You know, Prince is obviously a fan of all these people we're talking about. And it comes out in his music. And Bowie was very much that way as well. It's like, it's folk, it's rock, it's metal, it's, you know, mime, it's you know, literally oil painting. It's every influence you could imagine. And the fact that he was poetically writing down, you know, his experiences in America to get this album is actually pretty cool. And I didn't realize that. He listened to the songs. It's like, I didn't realize that was his observation of what the dark underbelly of America.
So I know we've spent quite a bit of time, you know, there's a couple of times where we've kind of lent into like NME's kind of critical side of it. I guess it's only fair to look at the other side, that they said that they considered Bowie's version of this song, that they said that he performed the unprecedented feat of beating the Stones on one of their own songs with Let's Spend the Night Together. Would you agree with that? Do you think that Bowie's version is the definitive version of the song? Or
I do, and I'm a huge Stones fan, but I prefer this one, actually. It's something that's faithful to the original, but there's something that's a bit wonky and cool and dirty and aggressive that I prefer. Yeah, so I'd agree with that for sure.
So let's move on to arguably the most well-known, the most iconic song on the album, so The Gene Genie, inspired by Detroit and New York. The first single from the album, it reached number 2 on the UK singles chart shortly before the album's release. So, you know, we've heard it so many times over the years. How important would you say this track is to you in terms of your development? And do you think it deserves that status over kind of all these other amazing tracks we've been talking about?
Again, I think it works in the context of them. I think the great thing about this album, it was all written, contrived, recorded within a certain period of time. The other album, the other albums, or certainly Ziggy Stardust, some of it was, he was still trying to fit it together. He was still trying to find his thing. This was a real concept, this record. And so yeah, Gene Genie, I know I had some interesting stories about that because, you know, the Sweets blockbuster came out around the same time. And I think Bowie, I think that was actually finished before this was. And so there's a debate whether he was like, well, shit, that sounds really good. I'd like to do something like that, and got it. So they were on the charts at the same time, if I'm not mistaken. But I love it. And it's so simple and so rock and roll and so perfect. And it's a perfect kind of addition to this album. It's like I was saying about, you know, the Run Riots and Shotguns on Hysteria. They're absolutely essential. They make all these songs work together. They make them sound better. And I think this song makes songs like Time and Aladdin Sane sound better than they would if it hadn't been on the album.
And it's interesting that obviously the Gene Genie had a music video directed by Mick Wall, who he'd support this theory that the video kind of helps raise this kind of Ziggy Aladdin Sane kind of image in the video, Bowie posing on location at the Mars Hotel, mixed in with studio and live footage. Now, we talked about Bohemian Rhapsody a few minutes ago. I think history tells us that Bohemian Rhapsody was the first true music video. Do you think this is evidence to say that Bowie wasn't that far off the trail himself, that he was kind of thinking about the same sort of things that, Queen would be thinking about only a year or two later?
I absolutely. And if anyone's going to think of it, it would be him. It would be like, well, wouldn't it be great if you could see what we're doing, you know, see a different medium, you know. That was Bowie's whole thing was actually getting the different mediums to work, to get it over in whatever way he could. So, yeah, that wouldn't surprise me at all.
And I guess, as you've touched on, there was some controversy surrounding the song that obviously when The Sweet released Blockbuster, the riffs are very similar. And I'd never realised, you know, obviously heard both these songs over the years. And it's until you kind of go back armed with that knowledge that you realise how similar the two riffs are. Do you think that that's the secret to the success of both songs? Because, you know, absolutely both these songs were really successful at the time.
I do. And I love them both. You know, I have both singles, both albums. And, you know, it was like, and I loved both of them. So it wasn't like, oh, I'm pissed off with this, sounds like this. It was like, no, I dig them both. But it is really simple as a guitar player. You know, you go, in fact, Ronson was just playing the eagle, and the bass is going, and it's like, wow, it's almost like a blues movement. It's like a Muddy Waters or Howlin' Wolf kind of approach to it. So again, you know, then you stick on all what the song's about. And you know, going back to the New York thing, it's just great imagery, you know, and it's so Bowie, it's so amazing, you know. So no, I think like I said, I love them both, and I think that it's, yeah, the most famous song on the record, you know.
And just a funny story about kind of more about that kind of The Sweet and David Bowie thing. So as we'd said, Gene Genie got number two, Blockbuster got to number one just a few weeks after Gene Genie missed out. So Nicky Chinn, who wrote Blockbuster, he recalls meeting Bowie shortly after the controversy arose. And I can just imagine this whole thing playing out. He says he looked at me completely deadpan and simply said, cunt. And then he got up and gave me a hug and said, congratulations.
Really? That's great. Yeah. Oh, that's brilliant. Brilliant.
So just a nice way to wrap that up. Let's get into that final track. So let's talk about Lady Grinning Soul, which, again, this one was actually written in London. So again, we'll touch on that a bit more in a moment. But our final track on the album, a lot's been said about it. You know, many call it reminiscent of like a Bond theme. Artist Tanya Stark said that Bowie was very inspired by the work of psychoanalyst Carl Jung when writing it. What are your thoughts on the song? Do you get any of those themes? Like, does it feel like a Bond theme, or do you get any kind of sort of like psychodynamic kind of stuff coming out of Lady Grinning Soul?
I think, again, it's really haunting. It's just got it's weird. It's off, and it's kind of, it's almost like structured avant-garde. It goes back to that thing. It's like with a lot of kind of even say like the Mike Garson playing, it goes off on a tangent. You can do that, and I think it's very hard to reel that stuff in. This feels reeled in a great way, in a commercial structure. So that's what I love about it. And it's got all those elements. It's really haunting. It just creates this ghostly image. It's like, it sounds like a ghost story to me. But sonically, again, I just love what it actually represents. But it's harnessed avant-garde. It's like I said, it's got a structure, but it could go really off the rails in any second. But it doesn't.
I mean, the song, it gets a lot of critical love. So Rolling Stone believe that Lady Grinning Soul has the album's most expansive and sincere vocal. Author Nicholas Pegg considers the track one of Bowie's most underrated recordings, quite unlike anything else he's ever done. Do you think, in that sense, obviously we've talked about so much how we like the track, do you think it is a hidden gem? Do you think it is a bit underrated compared to others?
I do, but I also think there's a reason it's the last track. I mean, a lot of bands or artists would put a hidden track on there. So this almost seems like it's done deliberately. It almost seems like it's an added bonus track. And I've always thought that for whatever reason, I've always thought, oh, I've discovered something. Was I supposed to hear this? That's what it kind of suggests. It comes over and it's got this beautiful guitar solo. Again, I was going to mention that. I always thought that Ronson should have used a nylon strung guitar. So, and I think he's using a steel strung acoustic guitar, I think. So I'd recently done a solo that was very reminiscent of that, only I used a nylon strung guitar. So, and it's an absolute ode to Mick Ronson and to the song, to Bowie. It's got a lot of stuff that's kind of a shout out to that and the influence, the massive influence that it had. But no, I think it's got this ghostly quality to it, and it just it makes you think of it's just sad. It's just got a sadness to it, you know, that's beautiful.
So unlike most of the tracks on the album, as I'd said, you know, most of these were written and inspired across America. Lady Grinning Soul was actually written in London. So it's almost like as we get to the end of the album, we're returning to that comfort and familiarity of home after this kind of sort of chaotic journey through Americana, I guess.
Yeah.
For you, I know you said you always feel like it's a bit of a, it almost felt like a bit of a bonus track. How does this end the album for you? Kind of where are you at when you get to the end of Aladdin Sane?
Well, it's very definitive. You know it's the end of the album. That's the other thing. I mean, bonus track or last track on the record, it certainly closes it. So I guess if I didn't really know that was written in London. I guess to come to a conclusion, you know, you've traveled all around the States and everything, and it goes, oh, okay, we're back here and we're doing that. Back to the 70s concept album and Bowie being a master of that, of concepts and lyrics and tying it in image-wise and sonically and melodically and all of those things. Genius stuff. People just don't do that anymore, you know. And actually it's rare that people did that anyway. Rock music as a medium is you know, laughed at, pop music especially, and frowned upon. But when you get something like this is the real deal. It's kind of really artistic. That's such a hard thing to do. You know, you listen to classical music or jazz music, sometimes there's a snobbery involved, not always, sometimes it's just fantastic, but it's hard to do it again within those parameters where you're making a different kind of music and you want it to count like a wonderful piece of jazz or a classical piece of music and as a piece of art. And I think he managed to do that, and this track sums it up perfectly.
So, I mean, this is an album a lot more layers than one might expect from a first listen, and I think obviously you'll know this better from me, from it being your classic album. I feel like it rewards you every time you return to it, time and time again, which of course so many of us do. I've got a quote here from Music Musings and Such that kind of sum up the impact of the album as we kind of get to the end of our chat. So they said, maybe there are finer and more complete works than Aladdin Sane, one thinks of Heroes and Low, but there are none, in my estimation, that are as important in Bowie's career than the 1973 release gem. Such was the importance and popularity of Aladdin Sane, it would be a little while before Bowie created another masterful album. Critical reaction from the US was stronger than it was in the UK, and it meant its popularity there grew enormously, which in turn inspired his future direction and popularity. The fact that Aladdin Sane is 45, as he was writing it, obviously we're nearer 50 at this point, but the fact that Aladdin Sane is 45 and still gathering huge acclaim, an investigation shows how important and impactful it was and how it signaled the rise and birth of an artist like no other. Summing all of that up and everything we've talked about, why do you think that Aladdin Sane has stood the test of time?
It was a conclusion to his earlier period. He actually, like I said, he was trying to find his voice, so to speak, and his image and all of this stuff. When he finally got that, he was able to close the book, and that's what this was. It was a culmination of everything that happened up until that point, and this allowed him to go close the book and become, you know, to whatever he did later on, Let's Dance, you know, Earthling, amazing pieces of work, but it allowed him to do that. And I think the conclusion of this particular record was literally the starting point of everything else. And it was the band, and it was like, guys, you know, this has been great, you know, especially those three albums, you know, Hunky Dory, Ziggy and Aladdin Sane. It allowed this real concept, this real artist, it birthed this particular artist, and it also allowed him to scratch the itch, close the book, and actually start his career.
And finally, why is Aladdin Sane your classic album, and why should people check it out if they haven't already?
It's got all the elements that I love on an album. I listen to it on vinyl occasionally, and it's great. It's got such depth. It's got depth like a classical album. It's got everything from what we're talking about, avant-garde jazz piano to you know, hard rock and Gene Genie, you know, and subject matter, you know, what the stories are about. And I, like I said, obviously America pops up in a lot of the lyrics, but I didn't know it was really about that totally, you know, and it totally makes sense. you know, because I've always listened to it as a song. So I've never really listened to it as a concept of kind of what he culminates, what his idea of America is about, you know, especially the darker side of it.
Well, Phil, it's been an absolute joy, as I've said. Thank you so much for coming on the show and talking about an awesome album as well. Obviously, you know, we've got the new, so it's the third box set of the Def Leppard studio albums coming out on June 11th. Coincidentally, we were talking about your cover of Driving Saturday. That's included in that box set because, yeah, it's going to be part of this release. That's right, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. We've got B-sides and we've got a Year 2 in there as well, which is, you know, it's tracks we've recorded over the years, and we're not really good about this because everything comes out, but bless Joe, he actually dug up all this stuff and was like, we've got a live version of this, we've got a recording of these different songs, and we got a whole album's worth as well. So it's like, just these other songs, just other covers that we've done over the, and there's a live Year. That's the third album of that as well. So it's pretty exciting, I've got to say. And especially if you know that we're fans, such big fans of Bowie, and everything that come out that shaped us, that era, that kind of that very early 70s stuff. You know, it kind of made us who we are today, like musically and otherwise. It started the ball rolling.
And I think as well, you know, I think what's exciting for me thinking about it is it's out on CD, but it's also out on vinyl. Am I right in thinking, so X, Year, and Songs from the Sparkle Lounge, which is another of my favourite Def Leppard albums, they've never been released on vinyl before, is that right?
I didn't know that, really.
I might be wrong, I'm going to have to double check.
You could be right, you know, because I thought I'd seen X. I'm not sure. Or it came out in a certain country, like you go to Italy and someone would have it and you go, wow, where'd you get that? It was that kind of thing. But yeah, they're all out. And I got the box set the other day, it got delivered and it was like, wow, this is really, really super cool. And it's great. It's great for fans. But for me as well, I'm like, wow, it really covers a lot of stuff on there. It's great.
And then, I mean, I know obviously COVID's kind of impacted things like touring. I know you were going to go on a big tour with Motley Crue and all that kind of stuff. Is there any plans to get back in the studio with Def Leppard or kind of picking up that tour, or what are the plans kind of going forward?
The tour, we're absolutely doing the tour. It starts next May. We've actually got the dates in. So it's the stadiums again. It's us, Motley, Poison and Joan Jett. So we're all back together. I've just started doing some, not gigs, but like I said, I did a thing with Slash, Robert DeLeo, and Forrest Robinson the other day, which was amazing, you know, in a little studio up in LA that's called Gold Diggers. Ed Wood, the director, used to do all this cheesy B-movie stuff in the 50s and early 60s. That was his old studio. So we recorded in there. And then last week I played with one of my idols, Chaka Khan, which was just amazing. So that's going to become, there's a thing called Black Girls Rock. It's a Black Girls Rock TV. And that's what we were doing it for, that. So that'll be coming out towards the end of the month. And the thing just aired, The Beastly Ball, which is the thing I did with Slash, Robert DeLeo, aired on Saturday. So if you can see that anywhere, that should be out there. And a thing that I redone a 70s jazz rock classic called Quadrant 4 by Billy Cobham. And I did that with Forrest Robinson and Craig Martin. That's out. There's a video of that. And that's just shred guitar and fun and you know, crazy stuff. So yeah, we're starting to move in the direction of getting it back together. We're constantly writing. This whole COVID time, me and Joe are constantly writing songs together. We got some killer stuff, and I'm just excited for whatever happens to any of that stuff. So yeah,
I mean, that's insane, isn't it? For me anyway, I think it's just one of those things where to think that you get to have this opportunity, and some people might be sick of me gushing a little bit, quite frankly, which I would completely understand. I think it was just a huge moment for me, loving Def Leppard for as long as I have, loving Bowie for longer, actually, you know, to be able to have this kind of conversation and the direction that it went in. And yeah, absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much to Phil Collin for joining me to chat about a fantastic album. Truly about time that we got some Bowie in the My Classic Album archives, so that's really great. Obviously, that box set that we were talking about at the end there, that is out now, and I would thoroughly recommend it. I think X is quite an underrated album, you know, if I'm getting in my kind of geeky Def Leppard mode, if you like. I think it gets dismissed as a bit of a poppy album, but there's some great tracks on there. The Yeah covers album is fantastic. Songs from the Sparkle Lounge, as I told Phil there, one of my favourite Def Leppard albums. It was a real return to form for them. So yeah, three great albums from arguably quite an underappreciated part of their career, and loads of extras there. There's a Yeah 2, Yeah Live, loads of cool stuff. And I think, to be fair, even if you're streaming, so I'm sure I was on one of the streaming sites and a lot of that stuff was on there. So really, if you're a Def Leppard fan, totally worth digging into and checking out. There's that amazing cover of Driving Saturday that's on Yeah, and then there's some cool Bowie covers in there too. I think there's a Ziggy Stardust cover, there's Rebel Rebel, Space Oddity. I really like the Space Oddity cover. So, you know, again, Def Leppard wearing their Bowie influences very, very much on their sleeves. So yeah, that's out now. I would thoroughly recommend it. And as I'd said, thank you to Phil for joining me. And that's another episode of My Classic Album done. Thank you very much to everyone for tuning in as usual. And you heard a little snippet of the next few episodes in the middle there. It was a nice opportunity to do that. And, you know, obviously, I am excited about next time because we're doing some Maiden. We're going to throw Iron Maiden in there. Power Slave, Emily Johansson. Absolutely, it's going to be a great episode. I really hope you enjoy it. And we'll see you in a couple of weeks for that. 5 years of My Classic Album. That's insane. We'll see you then. Cheers.